Welcome to No More Booze, the podcast. I'm Olivia Farrelly, and in every episode, I explore the role that alcohol has in our lives. I interview people who have decided to live their life with no more booze. We'll explore their relationship with alcohol, how it made their life better, how it made their life worse, any lessons they've learned along the way, and what advice they would give to others who are contemplating a life without alcohol. So whether you are sober curious, you're sober serious, or you're already living your life alcohol-free, this podcast will provide inspiration and motivation as you begin to untangle and reassess your relationship with the booze. Hi, everybody. Before we start this week's episode, I'm just going to offer a trigger warning. So this episode contains discussions of child sexual abuse and of suicide. And I know they are topics which people might find distressing. So please take care when you're listening. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to No More Booze, the podcast. Regular listeners will know that I have a deep obsession with near-death experiences. And today, my incredible guest, who I actually got full body chills there a second ago, thinking about our potential chat, is Betty Guadagno, all the way from New York. Betty?
Yes.
Amazing.
Brooklyn, New York, representing.
Amazing, amazing. Do you want to introduce the listeners to who you are and a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name's Betty. I'm dialing in from Brooklyn, New York. I have been in recovery for the last 6 years and 3 months today. June 1st, 2019 is my clean date. I grew up in a family of addicts. I have experienced super intense trauma in my life. And I had a near-death experience as a result of a drug overdose in 2019. And at the time, I was a radical atheist. I was a prostitute. I was a drug addict. I was homeless. So this wasn't really part of my picture. And I just wrote the whole thing off as drug-induced psychosis. But the universe stepped in a very loud, tangible way to let me know that my experience was a real one and that recovery was my only option. So I had a forced surrender, but I could not imagine my life any other way today. And that's the little elevator pitch about me.
Oh my God, amazing. A forced surrender. I think a lot of us have a bit of a forced surrender, don't we?
Definitely.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Do you want to share a little bit about, you know, what your life was like leading up to your near-death experience?
Yeah, I'll paint a picture of my origin story. Again, very traumatizing. This is my trigger warning to you. But I'm the daughter of addicts. My parents are both the children of addicts. Their parents are the children of addicts. And it's been that way for generations and generations. And it's exhausting being the one to break all the generational curses. But I guess that's what I'm doing. And I watched my parents' addiction really transform their lives. And my whole family is kind of this perpetual cycle of addiction and poverty and sexual trauma. And you're just taught at a very young age that if you smoke something or drink something or take a pill, that life won't be as terrible. So every time that we would get an eviction notice on our door, I watched my parents take a drink or take a pill. And that eviction notice didn't matter anymore. And they just quickly packed up the stuff and we'd move on to the next location. Instead of my dad taking weekend business trips, he would take weekend trips to jail. And I thought that was really normal. I thought that it was normal to have a long orange extension cord going from your apartment to the building so that your lights and refrigerator could be on. I didn't know that we were poor. I didn't know that my parents were dealing with addiction. I didn't know any of that stuff until I started to get around other kids and I saw that their families weren't like that. And then I realized that my family was very different. And in 2007, it was the height of the OxyContin epidemic, and my parents were prescribed over 1,000 pills each every month, and they were somehow always running out of pills. And so every month, it was this torment of withdrawal and pain and agony and poverty. And this one particular month, the lights were turned off, the gas was turned off, and they were about to be evicted for the 100th time. And they made the decision that they had to stop their suffering. They had to stop using. And They didn't know how to stop using drugs, except to do what everybody else in my family did to stop using drugs, and that was die. So in 2007, my parents intentionally overdosed. They committed suicide together. And it was obviously the most devastating, traumatizing thing that you could ever imagine. And my sister and I found them, and they wrote these notes on the kitchen magnet notepad, like where you write your grocery list. And it just said, take care of each other. As if an 18-year-old and a 23-year-old would know how to do that. But after my parents died, my addiction stepped in and it became my parent. It became my whole identity. And I rocked and rolled with it until it killed me.
Okay. Wow. So you were 23 at that time. And your sister was 18. Wow.
Yeah.
So what kind of drugs were you using then?
So I had just detoxed myself. I had like 2 weeks off of pills, but pills was our family business. Like we would doctor shop, everybody was on pills. So when my parents died, two voices came into my head and one said, oh, you're going to need to use drugs. Like you need drugs. It's the legacy of your family. They can't use anymore. So now you have to use for you and for them. And then the other voice was like, you need to stay far, far away from drugs. But the voice that told me this thing about my family legacy, that voice just sunk in and it seemed easier to listen to that voice. And so that's what I did. I just went right back to, I became an insatiable alcoholic. I used to piss in my car, like while driving, like can't pull over, can't pop a squat. Like I would be so wasted driving around that I would just pee in my car. And my sister had enough and she was like, I can't be around you. And so we just kind of abandoned each other. Like she begged me to move away and I didn't fight it. And so I moved across the country. I abandoned her. She abandoned me. But I turned to any kind of substance that I could get my hands on to deal with that grief and that abandonment.
Wow. And, you know, we know a lot, well, we're beginning to know a lot about, certainly in the last few years, about adverse childhood experiences and how, like, the more we experience in our early years, how traumatizing that is for our later years. And, like, you went through the whole gamut of adverse experiences.
Yeah, definitely. Childhood sexual trauma. I was molested by a family member when I was small. My parents were very physically and emotionally abusive all throughout my life. And then I found boyfriends that mirrored my parents. And it was just this whole cycle that just continued to affect me until I stepped into recovery. And I always just thought that I had bad luck. I was like, oh, every guy that I pick is just why. I have, they say in 12 step, like, oh, you have a bad picker. But it's not that I have a bad picker. It's that I am prone to patterns. Yeah. And so my soul will continue to present me with the same lesson over and over again until I pass class. I have to step in and say, oh, you know what? I don't want this lesson anymore. I'm ready to learn.
Absolutely. And actually, I was talking to this with somebody, actually, I think only today. It's energy. So we're used to certain energies in our lives, right? So like my husband is incredibly calm. It's like he's an actual angel. We always talk about this. We call him Saint Gary. But he's so calm in this house. I'd be more fiery. He has calmed everything down. Our children know calmness, so they will I hope they will replicate calmness. So when they're in a situation, this is what I hope anyway, that when they're in a situation where there's maybe heightened energy or there's red flag central, they will run like the hills from them red flags.
I hope that for your kids too, definitely. And now that I've done some healing and I've been in recovery for a minute, my reflections of the people around me are totally different. You know, I never even knew that there were healthy people in the world. I thought that everybody was traumatized and traumatizing others, because that's what I ended up doing. It wasn't just that I was a person who had suffered a lot of trauma. I then flipped the script and said, I will never be a victim ever again in my life. Now I will traumatize everybody. I will be the perpetrator. I'll be the abuser. Because I didn't even know that there were other roles to play. I thought that it was only victim and perpetrator.
Yeah. Absolutely. And do you know, like, you hear this saying kind of bandied about a lot, hurt people hurt people. So it's just, the things that are done onto you, you just do onto other people.
Absolutely. And healed people heal people. And that's the other side of it.
Oh God, I love that. And healed people heal people. That's so true, isn't it? Do you want to bring us up to the day where you had your near-death experience? So what did that look like that day?
Yeah, so that day it just looked like I had taken a little bit extra of all of the substances that I would use on a daily basis. So I was going to go do my laundry and I thought, oh, I might as well get real messed up because laundry is so boring. And I took a little bit extra. And at that time in my life, I was doing everything, like every kind of drug. But my main drugs were that I was a heroin addict and I was a methamphetamine addict. And then I was abusing psychedelics every chance that I could as well. So that particular day I took too much, and my near-death experience was not something that I had known anything about. I had never heard of a near-death experience. I had never heard of a spiritual awakening. I was completely offline when it came to anything like this. My whole life was just getting drugs, using drugs, manipulating people, stealing, lying, cheating, whatever I had to do to make sure that I was medicated and sedated and not sick. And so in my spiritual experience, I started to experience a life review. And like I shared, I was a traumatized person who was maliciously, intentionally traumatizing other people. And so in my life review, I started to experience that pain, and it was devastating. I caused so much agony to other people, and I didn't even know because I was so self-centered that I didn't even care. And so in this life review, I was experiencing all of that, and it was very, very painful. And it felt like I was in hell. And I didn't believe in anything because I was an atheist. I only believed that once you die, like that's it, lights out, it's over. But this experience, I thought, oh, I'm dead, and it's much worse than I imagined because I'm stuck now in hell. And then throughout this life review experience, I was experiencing my parents' suicide from their perspective, and the pain, the physical pain that they were in, I could feel that from their withdrawal. And then the emotional pain that they were in, it just felt like I was drowning in an ocean of anguish and despair, and like every cell in my body was being shredded apart, covered in concrete, like ripped in static. It was just so insanely painful. And I thought, okay, I'm definitely dead because I see my parents and I know my parents are dead. And this is it. This is what the afterlife is. I'm stuck in agony. And then I started to hear my dad's voice, and he was chanting, "You are worthy of all the love in the universe. You are worthy of all the love in the universe." And even though I didn't believe that statement, I trusted his voice. And so I started to follow his voice. And that's when I landed in the light of my experience, which was very welcome because it was quite different from my life review experience. And in the light part of my experience, it just felt like reunion and connection. And safety and security and joy and elation and serenity and peace and calm. And it was so insanely different from what I had just been experiencing. And I was so happy to be in that space and to feel those feelings. And then I started to be downloaded with the meaning of life. Why does Earth exist? Why are we all going through these things? And I was shown that I had signed up for every experience that I had had in my life. I signed up for addiction. I signed up for prostitution. I signed up for childhood sexual trauma and all the other sexual traumas that happened to me throughout my life. I signed up for abuse. I also signed up for recovery. I signed up for spiritual awakening. I signed up to be a teacher, to be an author. But I hadn't gotten to any of those things in my life yet. So it didn't make any sense to me that I had signed up for those things. But the other stuff made sense to me. And so the way that it came through in my mind's eye was that I was going through a spiritual supermarket. And I had a big empty grocery cart. And then inside of this spiritual supermarket, lining the walls of the grocery store aisles were these giant cereal boxes. And all of these cereal boxes had different life experiences on them. So I was just throwing everything in the cart, everything I could get my hands on. I want to experience all that Earth has to offer. And when I picked this box of this childhood sexual trauma, a little orb of light came out with the box. And that orb of light was the soul of the man who molested me when I was a kid. And our souls came orb to each other, and we came into contract that we were going to play these roles for each other because we loved each other so much. Now, my human mind cannot comprehend this. Why would you show your love to another soul by harming them in such a devastating way? But my spirit knows this as a fact. This is, I don't ever have to argue with this. This is just something that I have innate knowing of now. And so when I was downloaded with this understanding that I am a divine co-creator of my life, I'm not a victim to my circumstance. Things just haven't been randomly happening to me. There's a divine blueprint to why this is all happening to me. It felt like the chains of victimhood had been released from me. It felt like I could float out into the ether, like a pinball, just like pinging all over the place. I was so free and I was so excited. And I refused to come back here. They had given me all this information about life and the meaning and the blueprint and the plan. And I just refused to come back here. I didn't want to come back to Earth. I kept affirming to the beings that I was in this light experience with that Earth is a dumpster fire. I feel tricked. I feel manipulated. Nobody told me what it was really going to be like. And they just kind of chuckled and said, yeah, we do tell you. You absolutely know. And you say this every time you come back here, and you've gone to Earth an infinite amount of times. We're always just going back home and coming back to play these roles because it's fun. It's like being an actor in a play. And every time I go back home, I get a new role that I get offered to play. And so I'm a workaholic, so I just keep coming back to Earth to play these parts. But my experience, I just wrote it off as drug-induced psychosis because I didn't think that it was a real one, because this wasn't part of my picture. I was just a junkie on my bathroom floor when all of this was happening. So I just kind of sat up when I came back from the experience and thought, damn, I was so high. I'll never be that high again. I was so high that I thought I was talking to God. I was so high that I thought I planned my life. That's crazy. That's bananas.
And did you experience God, or was it in the form of Jesus, or what, angels?
Yes. So there was spirit guides. There were beings of light. There was this beautiful tube of etheric light. It was so bright, brighter than anything I can't even put it into words, really. And I believe that it was the energy of Christ or Krishna or Buddha. It doesn't matter like what word we use. It's all the same thing. Every mythology has a different archetype for it, but it was something higher. It was something loving and caring.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you think now that we have we're on a linear timeline and we have specific points that we meet, and like at 28 you're going to do this, at 37, and then if we miss those points, somebody else comes back in and they, you know, it comes later on. We're just meant to do certain things. Is that what you think now?
I do believe that there are specific plot points that are set up for you throughout your life. Now, we still have free will. So it's not, when it comes to pre-birth planning or this idea that everything is mapped out beforehand, it's not that we've planned every meal or every bowel movement. It's that just that these major markers have been set up. So and there's an infinite amount of plans, but the idea for pre-birth planning for me is that I cannot mess up what is meant for me. So three of my cereal boxes, my pre-birth planning plot points, are addiction, recovery, spiritual awakening. Now, I could have gone into recovery. The first time I ever went to rehab, I was 18. I could have hopped into that recovery lesson, already had my addiction lesson, and then I would have had a spiritual awakening slow and steady as a result of practicing the 12 steps in a 12-step fellowship. But instead, I kept exercising my own self-will, my free will. and say, and I was ignoring the internal GPS that was telling me to get off the highway, to make a U-turn. You have to get onto a different path. And I had been in detoxes and rehabs over a dozen times in my life before I actually stepped into recovery, because I too needed that big gun. I needed the head honcho to come in and say, no, girl, like, you have to stop for real. So I didn't have to prolong my pain for as long as I did. I could have stepped into the lesson of recovery and spiritual awakening much softer and sooner, but I'm stubborn and I needed a bucket of spiritual bricks thrown at my face in order to get my lesson. And so that's the route that it came.
Wow. And I've always used the saying, like, I've stolen it from Oprah or somewhere, like, it was a pebble, and then it was a brick in the face. So, like, as we always say, like, our life is trying to tell us something. And you know what I think, like, obviously people will listen to this. Maybe this is their brick in the face, listening to you.
Please let it be. Please let it be. I wish that I had the awareness that I could just learn from other people. I really thought that I had to learn everything from firsthand experience, but today I know better. I will learn from other people's mistakes. When I go into the rooms of my 12-step fellowship and I hear people share that had decades in recovery and then they relapsed and they went back out and the pain and the struggle to come back in, I don't ever have to learn that lesson for myself if I don't want to. I can learn from other people, and that's a superpower.
Yeah. I got a DM yesterday morning from a lady who was simply listening to the podcast for a year. And she's like, she said yesterday morning, I am a year off alcohol today simply from listening to other people's stories. And it's just, that's what it is. You know, that Ram Dass saying, we're all just walking each other home, you know, and it's the veil that comes when we incarnate onto earth that we forget that we're truly magnificent and beautiful and all those things. And we believe the shitty things that the world tells us about ourselves that we are. But, you know, I said this a couple of weeks ago, I went to see Gabrielle Bernstein a couple of weeks ago here in Ireland, and what she said, and it goes to what you were saying, you're this divine co-creator of your life, and, like, don't strangle the process. Like, you know, from your experience on the other side, like, what are we supposed to do? Are we just supposed to, like, you know, who else? Is it Tony Soprano or Olivia Soprano says it's all a big nothing? Like, you know, do we take life too seriously? Should we just kind of let it go, you know?
Oh my gosh. Yes. This is supposed to be fun. So, yeah. But it's not, I mean, it doesn't feel fun for a lot of people, but it is supposed. So I'm a teacher and a student of A Course in Miracles, which is a channeled message from Jesus. It's like this metaphysical text. It's channeled through the mind of a militant atheist psychotherapist from New York in the 1970s. And in this book, Jesus says very clearly that this is a dream that we're inside of. And the reason why it feels as serious as it does is because we forgot to laugh and we forgot that we were dreaming. And so every day I make it my mission to remember to laugh, and not to discount the fact that people are going through real suffering. Like my day job, you know, I work as a transformation coach as one part of my career. And then the other part of my career, I work for a substance use disorder clinic in New York City. And I go out and I do outreach with a collection of peers. We're all people with lived experience. And we hand out snacks and water and try to get homeless people connected to care. And people are suffering. Yeah. And yeah, I feel like my whole life now is centered in this place where I could take this all very seriously and be enraged and feel like a victim and be questioning why and cursing God and everything that is. But instead, I choose to live my life led by certain spiritual principles, certain spiritual texts, because they give me hope. And in A Course in Miracles, it says that God doesn't even know that we're here, that this whole dream is of our making, and that all we have to do is remember to laugh and we can go into a different layer of the dream. So I'm not laughing at people's suffering, but I do remember to just take in the awareness that this world is not what we think it is. I mean, I've been to another world in that spiritual experience that I know is real reality. So why am I taking the game, the movie, the book, the choose your own adventure that I'm in here so seriously?
Yeah. One of the first I bought Audible to listen to Anita Morjani's near death experience on years ago. And I have her the five things that she experienced. I have them on my wall here. I'm going to read them out. I think I've read them out before. But number one is focus your awareness on love. All life's challenges are gifts. Live your life fearlessly. Exactly what you said there. Fill your day with laughter, humor, and joy. Life is a gift, and always be yourself.
So good. Yeah, some of my big takeaways is that change is inevitable. What's meant for you will always find its way to you. You're an actor in a play. You don't have to be a method actor. You don't have to take your role so seriously. I think about actual method actors, like Daniel Day-Lewis. When he was in Lincoln, he would only speak with 19th century English, you know, Christian Bale lost like 60 pounds to be in The Machinist. Like, y'all, we don't need to take it so seriously here. Like, we're spirits playing a game. Your human that you're inside of is your costume. So, you know, take care of your costume, treat it well. You know, like for me, that means I don't fill it with poison. Today I'm a gluten-free, sugar-free vegan, and I only drink water and I exercise my body regularly. I used to eat pills out of other people's puke. That is literally a part of my story. So if transformation's available to me, then transformation's available to everybody. And this whole human experience is about transformation. We're caterpillars and we're not meant to stay them. Caterpillars transform into beautiful butterflies. So allow yourself the opportunity to transform.
Yeah. And wasn't it the Buddha who said that, like, one of our deepest flaws as humans is that we can't accept change. We always want things to stay the same.
Think about all the times in your life where you were forced into a change, whether it's sobriety or something else. But I think about all the times when I had these forced shifts in my life, and they always work out to be so much better than I ever could have imagined. And so if I just surrender and flow to the feeling of change, then I don't have to have all that resistance, which makes my life unmanageable.
Yeah, amazing. So taking us back to, so you had the near-death experience, did you return to the way you were living, and how long were you in that way of life for before you really kind of integrated?
So, I just thought that it was drug-induced psychosis. So of course, I just went back to living my life the way that I was living it, like using drugs, prostituting myself, abusing my body, abusing other people's bodies, hating life, wanting to die every day. And I stayed like that for a couple months. And then the universe stepped in and made my path very narrow so that I had no choice but to go into recovery. And one of the ways that the universe did that was all my drug dealers on the same day decided to change their lives and stop selling drugs, like 10 different men. I'd call up one, my main dealer, I called him up. I said, "Hey man, what's up? I want to pick up. Where can I meet you?" And he said, "Listen, I'm out of the game. I want to be a good father. I found Jesus. Don't ever call me again." Click. Hangs up on me, blocks me. This is a man that I was dealing with for 10 years. So I was devastated. I was like, what? I don't understand. What did I do? What's going on? So then I call up the next guy on the list and he tells me the exact same story. Found Jesus, wants to be a good dad, out of the game. I'm like, what the F is going on? Where has Jesus been hiding? How are all of these men finding Jesus? This is so crazy. I did that 10 different times. And every time they hung up on me and they blocked me. And so it became impossible. I went around the streets in New York City finding what I needed because, you know, I had a physical dependency to heroin. So I needed to use. And every time that I would pick up from the street or like in a bar or, you know, in a housing project, it would be fake. It would be bunk. It wouldn't work, or it would start raining outside and it would get wet and I wouldn't be able to use it. Or there'd be a hole in my pocket that I didn't know about and I'd get home and it would be gone. everything that could happen was just shoving me in this really narrow path. And I found myself on a train and I had no destination. And it was the middle of the day in New York City and there was nobody in this train car, which is crazy because we have 9 million people here. The fact that there's nobody else sitting in this train is weird. And the doors opened and a man stepped inside and he sat directly across from me, even though the whole train car was empty. And around his neck was this big blinged out emblem of a 12-step fellowship, these big shiny letters staring me in the face. And I heard a voice and it said, "That's your path. Follow him to a meeting." And so I asked this strange man on the train if he happened to be going to a meeting. And guess what? He was on his way to a meeting and he took me with him. And that was the beginning of my recovery journey. And I went to another meeting the next day because they told me I had to make 90 meetings in 90 days. And I think that they say that because there's some science somewhere that says that it takes 90 days to create a new habit. But I was so desperate. They broke it down to me really simply. They said, "You use drugs every day. You got to make meetings every day. This is your new drug. This is what you're going to do." And so I went to a women's meeting the next day. And when I walked through the door, I was destroyed. I was missing most of my teeth. Now I've paid for some teeth. My eyes were dead. My skin was gray. I was totally sunken in. My whole body was covered in sores and holes because every time that I got high, I thought that bugs lived inside of me. And so I would cut myself open with razor blades and I'd burn myself with torches trying to get the bugs out of me. And so when I walked into this room and this room full of women saw me, they could tell that I was new because it was painfully obvious. And this one woman came up and she hugged me and she held me so tight. And she whispered in my ear and she said, "You are worthy of all the love in the universe. You are worthy of all the love in the universe." And it's the same message that my dad said to me in my spiritual experience. And I melted into this woman and I let out this deep guttural cry. And I rested my head on her big boobies for as long as she would let me. And I surrendered. I surrendered. I didn't feel worthy of all the love in the universe, but I thought maybe I'm worth more than addiction. Maybe I'm worth more than prostitution. Maybe I'm worth more than wanting to kill myself every day. And that was the beginning of this journey for me.
Wow. Oh my God, I have tears in my eyes. Isn't that like, and for her words to mirror that of what was said, how utterly incredible. Do you know? Think no, believe that you're worthy of all the love in the universe.
I do. It's taken me a long time to get here. I probably didn't actually start believing it until this year. Okay. I mean, I knew that I was worthy. I know that God loves me. I know that God loves all of us. It's not specific to me. Like if some homeless crackhead is worthy of all the love in the universe, then you better bet your ass that you are too. But you know, there's still a lot of things about me that I'm working on. You know, I let go of drugs and alcohol. And what am I left with? A real fucked up personality, the personality that was doing all of those things. So, you know, for the last 6 years, I've been on this quest to surrender my defects of character, to let go of judgment and control and defensiveness. And it's not linear. Some days are better than other days. I have rituals and routines. I had all these other manifestations of addiction pop up in my life when I let go of drugs and alcohol. Like I developed a bunch of really nasty eating disorders that they were always there, but I was too sedated to recognize it. And when I let go of drugs and alcohol, my eating disorders were so present in my life. And I thought that I was actually going to kill myself because I had all this spiritual knowledge and awareness and I knew that God was with me, but I didn't feel like God was powerful enough to help me with the food stuff, only with the drug stuff. Like, how could I ask God for more? God got me off drugs. How can I ask God to help me with the eating disorders? And I felt like I had to figure it out on my own and that didn't work. But I ended up working the 12 steps around the stuff with the food. And I have years of freedom away. I also, my other addictions, addiction to other people. Have you ever heard of this word called limerence? It's where you get desperately obsessed with another person. It's like fantasy addiction. I've heard somebody in 12-step call it skin covered dope. Like I would get obsessed with people that didn't even know that I existed. And I would make up fantasy relationships inside my head where we have like children and a house and, like a dog and the whole thing. And I would become, it was a dopamine hit to go into that fantasy. And so I was so not present in reality because I was constantly going off into this fantasy relationship inside my head. Productivity addiction, like I'm a workaholic now. So like so many different manifestations of addiction in my life. It's like whack-a-mole. You let go of one thing and another thing pops up.
And like we're so deeply complicated as humans, you know, it's exactly what you said. One thing goes and another thing kind of hops up. But you mentioned there, like, trying to give up judgment, control, and defensiveness. They are kind of huge things that I'm kind of working on as well. And, you know, gossiping as well. That's,
I love it. I'm sorry, I do. And you know what it is? It's like it's my childhood trauma, which I'm not going to blame it on that. Like obviously I've carried it with me throughout life, but there's patterns in my life that were established when I was very young. And so for me, it felt like I was connecting with people more when I was tearing other people down. And this is that kind of manipulative shadow part of myself who doesn't believe that I'm good enough just as me to have authentic connection with other people. That in order for me to connect with others, we have to have a common enemy.
But that's very common. You know, sometimes we figure out that we've a lot in common with people when we have the common hatred of somebody we know and that we can kind of tear them down.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, okay, I'm gonna use that. That's how I'm gonna defend that character defect.
Amazing. So, like, then, you know, you start going to the 12-step meetings. How long did it take before your life kind of began to look better?
So I went into a long-term rehab and I stayed in there for nearly a year and a half. So I was safe. I didn't have to worry about rent or clothing or food because all of my basic needs were taken care of. And that's really what I needed so that I could get a foundation in recovery, integrate my spiritual experience, which I still didn't know what the fuck that was. I still didn't know that I had had a spiritual experience. I just thought that I was actually dead. And I thought that I had to do good deeds to get back to heaven because God rejected me from heaven and put me back down on earth. So I thought that one of the good deeds that I had to do was be in recovery. So every time I made it to a recovery milestone while I was in treatment, I would cry out to God and I would say, "Okay, God, I haven't used drugs in 30 days. Are you coming back to get me yet?" And I would not hear anything. And then I would make it to another milestone, like, "Okay, it's been 6 months. Like, where the fuck are you? Please come and get me." And still nothing. And so it wasn't until I got to around 6 months that I thought, okay, maybe I'm actually just going to be here and I just need to make life a life worth living. And I didn't leave treatment for a year and a half. And I don't think that my life necessarily felt like it was in order, but I definitely had a great firm foundation in recovery. So I knew that I could deal with whatever life was going to throw my way with unwavering faith in spirit, because my spirituality was so deeply developed and without turning to substances to cope with reality. Now, I was still coping with reality with eating disorders and sugar addiction and stuff, but I don't know. I feel like around year two, I finally started to feel proud of myself. Like, wow, you've accomplished a lot and you're doing really, really great. My obsession to use probably lifted after maybe 3 months. 3 months, that's when like it wasn't all day, every day that this voice was like, "You need to leave treatment. You need to go get high." But it's been this slow and steady, building a foundation, this building this house of recovery that I live in now.
And do you feel now that like maybe alcohol and drugs are completely insignificant in your life, or is it something you work on every day?
The voice definitely isn't as loud. And part of my healing practice is that I design the different parts of myself and I give them a personality and a character. So I have my addiction, my drug addiction. He's a man. He's a gay man named Richard. And he thinks he's so fun and fabulous, but he's a mess. And he lives inside of a glass house inside my mind. And that glass house is actually made of all of the insanity of my addiction. So when I think about the house that he lives inside of, the walls are lined with every insane thing that I did in active addiction, all the times that I said yes when I wanted to say no, all the people that I manipulated and hurt, all the times that I stole from other people, places, and things, like everybody that I abandoned, everybody that I got strung out on drugs, like it's insane in there. And but he still yells through the house and he'll say, like, let's have a drink, let's have fun. And sometimes I walk past bars and I think, like, why can't I do that? You know, and it's really just, it's jealousy. It doesn't have anything to do with like the getting drunk or the ritual of it or anything else. It's just how come they can do it and not fall apart, have their life fall apart into pieces, and I can't. And it's just because I have the disease of addiction and they don't. And you know, that's okay. They're at where they're at and I'm at where I'm at. It's not anything like it used to be. It used to be all day, every day, Richard screaming at me to destroy my life. Now it's like maybe once a week he'll pop up and be like, hey, remember, I'm here. I mean, my whole life is so centered in recovery now. My job is about recovery. My network is everybody in my network is are people in recovery. I don't have anybody in my life who parties or anything like that. So it would be a very hard sell for Richard to convince me that I should, you know, turn the page and do something nuts.
So you went from being totally atheist into having this incredible belief. Dr. Tara Swart was on a podcast with Diary of a CEO a couple of weeks ago, right? And she was talking about the signs, right? And like deeply spiritual work, like the stuff me and you probably know, haven't experienced, or in my case, read a lot of. And you know, we're coming to the point now, I think, in humanity where it's not that we have five senses. She said, I think we have like 83. So we're able to intuit things. Maybe we have psychic abilities, all that kind of thing. So, like, I've experienced sometimes a voice in my head that's, and you know, I'm rock steady Eddie of like a message. Once actually, I did that, but I'm quite intuitive. I'll guess stuff before it's even said. So I, you know, my lifetime ambition is to be psychic. But I love that I'm very intuitive. But once when I was coming up to a roundabout in Dublin, it's a really famous roundabout called the Walthamstow Roundabout. So I heard this voice very clear in my head, and it was, "We are always with you." Right. And then I was reading a book. I can't remember the name of the book that I was reading recently, but the message of it was, we are always with you. So, like our spirit guides and all this. So, I just think that, anyway, back to the point that Tara Swart was talking about the fact now that, like, science is catching up what certain people have experienced in their life. So, like, there's not as many naysayers, or, you know, if you were saying, going around saying, oh, I hear things, you know, people are going to put you into like a psychiatric facility and call you schizophrenic. But this is like, you know, this is how people experience things. Would you kind of agree with that? Your world opened up.
Yes, my world blasted open and I was really scared. I was really scared at first because I was scared that I was going to get hospitalized and institutionalized. And in fact, I took myself to the psych ward and I said, I don't know what the is going I don't know what the heck is going on. I think that I'm dead and everything in the universe is telling me that I am dead. And the director of psychiatry at this particular hospital said to me, well, perhaps you've reached a level of consciousness that I can't comprehend. And that's not everybody's story. Some people get institutionalized and they get heavily medicated and shocked and treated like garbage. And these are people who are going through spiritual awakening. There's this great TED Talk, and it's called Spiritual Awakening or Psychosis. And it's incredible. And what this man says is that in indigenous cultures, when somebody starts hearing voices, The medicine men and women of the tribe will take that teenager, because it usually happens in adolescence, and they will begin to cultivate that gift for that member of the tribe. Now, in the Western world, we don't do things like that because we're so disconnected from spirit. And so instead, we medicate, we sedate, we institutionalize. And I truly believe that spiritual experiences without community-based integration equal psychosis. And it's very easy to slip into spiritual psychosis. Everything is unseen and it can become very imbalanced. And so I believe in the power of community. That's why I'm a part of a 12-step fellowship. And it's why I belong to, you know, a handful of spiritual communities. Because I know that if I'm with myself, I'm in bad company. I'm the person who got me into this mess in the first place. So let me get around other people that I can use as mirrors and teachers and mentors and friends and enemies and allies, whatever it looks like. And I know that if I can get around other people, then I'm in good shape. But utilizing signs and synchronicities as a part of my path, if you can't think, it's a muscle too. So it's just like going to the gym and picking up a weight. If I go to the gym, I try to pick up a 500-pound weight, like I think I'm going to be a psychic medium in 1 second, I'm probably going to be wildly disappointed and throw my back out. But if I pick up a 2-pound weight and I just start practicing little tiny things like, okay, universe, today send me a blue ball. And then all of a sudden the blue ball appears. Then I know that I'm on the right path and I can use those signs as confirmation. So the universe will always speak to us in sequences of numbers. So if you ever see 1111 on the clock or on a license plate, that's the universe speaking to you, any sequence of numbers. If you see feathers that are just kind of random, you don't see a bird around them, they're just there in your path. Like, why is there a feather on my kitchen stove? There's no feathers in here, but you know, it's there because it's the universe talking to you. Pennies, I guess they don't have pennies where you live, but like pennies from heaven, like little coins, they'll come into your path. And then like cardinals are loved ones that have passed over. Butterflies are loved ones that have passed over. They'll come through in those kind of blanketed signs, or you can ask for specific ones.
I was at a funeral recently and there was a bird in the church.
Wow. That's definitely them. Wow. Yeah.
And when the eulogy was finished, the bird flew and flew back.
No.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible.
It's funny. I asked for a sign. I was having it, making a decision a couple of weeks ago, and I asked for a pink tortoise, very specific. And I told my two friends, I was like, I've met them for lunch, and I was like, girls, I'm looking for to make a decision if you see a pink tortoise. So we literally ended it at that and kept chatting. And I love podcasts, and I was like, any good podcasts? And my friend Aoife handed me the phone. She said, this is a great podcast. And in the corner of the podcast, written in pink, was tortoise.
No.
Yeah, literally. So that was like, that was my sign. Another one is a purple seahorse, like to know that what I'm on the right track. Isn't that it?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I love that so much. Yeah, I've asked for there's literally no signs left for me because I'm constantly like everything has some kind of meaning for me now. And I love the specifics of the pink. The color attached to what it shouldn't be. One time I was kind of testing the universe is really what I was doing. Like, am I, you know, okay, if I see a squirrel, like whatever, that's pretty regular, but send me a pink elephant. And then I thought of all the ways that I could see a pink elephant. Oh, maybe Dumbo will be on TV and I'll see it. Or maybe I'll walk past a bar and they'll have that beer on the sandwich board with the pink elephant on it. And I let it go. And I asked for this. And that's the thing is like, you have to let it go after you ask for the sign. And I happened to come down to the common room. This is when I was in treatment still. And the TV was on and it was New Year's Day. And they were showing the New Year's baby, the first baby born for the new year. And behind her was a big floating pink elephant balloon. And it was so perfect. And I just, I really know. And Wayne Dyer has a quote. It says, when I believe it, I'll see it. So most of us think when I see it, I'll believe it. But if you start to believe, your whole universe will look for confirmation of your belief. It's confirmation bias. So just start filling your world with things that you would like to see. You want to see more spirit? You want to see more miracles in your life? Believe that you're worthy of them. You're Miracles are your birthright. They're every single one of our birthrights. And just if you start believing it, you'll start to experience it.
Yeah. And Wayne Dyer's book, I Can See Clearly Now, is his kind of memoir, and he looks back, and the amount of coincidences, synchronicities, it would blow your mind in that.
Totally.
When I gave up the booze, and I had a call with a load of people during the week, and we were talking about the dark night of the soul, right? So it's definitely that when we're going from one experience or one part of ourselves or one identity into another, and like it's that kind of realization that our patterns were wrong, that we were on the wrong path, that we mightn't have as much in common with the people we thought were our lifers or whatever. And it's just that kind of uncomfortable, icky feeling, maybe between two spaces. Would you have kind of experienced a kind of what you would consider a dark night of the soul?
What? My whole life was a dark night of the soul. Yes, yes. But also being in spiritual awareness, it's funny because I'm working with a handful of people right now that are all really going through a very intense dark night of the soul. And the thing to remember about the dark night of the soul is that there is light on the other end of it. Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. This is a saying that we have in recovery too. You don't know when your miracle is going to come, so just keep going. If you're waiting for the miracle of not feeling that urge to go back and drink, like every day, like you're trying to stay sober, you're like, okay, today I'm not going to drink, but I still really, really want to. Just keep at it, because you don't know. You don't know what day it's going to happen when all of a sudden you don't have the desire to drink anymore. And it's the same thing with a dark night of the soul. You don't know when you're going to start to see the light again. So just keep going. Don't give up. I think of the whole world as a game of chutes and ladders. I got to keep going. And just keep going. And I don't know, there might be a chute somewhere that will send me right back down to the bottom, but I just have to keep on going and know that eventually I will get to the top. And yeah, the dark night of the soul can be really overwhelming. In my own experience, I started to feel extreme isolation because I had this very intense connection to the other side. And so I was talking to my dad every day, and I was talking to archangels, and I was talking to Jesus, and I was talking to all of these higher entities, but I had no human people. And so one day I just prayed out and I said, please manifest into physical people for me. I need to find the members of my soul family. I need to find my tribe here. Please send them to me. And that's when I found all of my communities. And I am immersed with other spiritual people, other people in recovery. My whole life is led by connection to others and connection to spirit.
Absolutely incredible. And, you know, I'm sure if you look back at yourself, probably at your lowest, there is no way that you are beautiful. You're just beaming with light. You're so funny. You know, it's probably the most incredible transformation in the whole wide world.
I have before and after pictures that will blow your brain off. They're on my social media, which is Buddha Betty. I'm on all social media, but really it's incredible to actually look at the difference between the two people. I can't even believe that I ever was that other person. And I think the biggest part of healing is integrating that version of myself into this version of myself. So I can't just reject her and ignore her and say, ugh, you embarrassed me. I hate everything about you. Like, what a mess you were. I have to say, hey, you were doing the best that you could with the information that you had, and all that you could do was survive. And at least you survived, so that I could become who we are today and who will continue to be in the future. And so that's really that was the most challenging part of recovery and integration for me, was like learning to love and accept that last version of myself.
And that is it in a nutshell, isn't it? Integrating. So when we make these powerful changes in our lives and we leave that part behind with peace and love, and then we have to integrate the two. Betty, you are just, I thank you. Oh, I feel such love and gratitude towards you. It has been an incredible conversation. You mentioned there where people can find you, but can you just remind us there where people can find you?
Yes, and thank you so much for this space, Olivia. It is so needed. You are doing such a great service to humanity and the collective by creating space like this. So thank you so much. I also love your accent. Do you hate when American people are like, oh my God, your accent is so cute? But it really is. And if anybody wants to connect, please feel free to reach out. I have a website. It's buddhabetty.com. It's just a play on words. I'm not really a Buddha. But I have free spiritual sharing communities on those. One of them is Europe time zone friendly. We meet Sundays at 12 p.m. Eastern. And the other is Tuesdays at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Free for everybody. All are welcome. We talk about different topics, spiritual topics. And yeah, anybody that wants to connect, please feel free to reach out. I'm so grateful for this space. Thanks for letting me share a piece of myself with you today.
It's amazing. And imagine the next life review we're going to have. It's going to be spectacular.
It will be tits. It will be very, very different. Yes.
Thanks, Betty.
No More Booze, the podcast, is produced, mixed, and mastered at the studios of Irish Audio Drama. For more information, visit irishaudiodrama.com.